So my name is Roberta Paladini. I work at IPAC, which is so the Processing Astronomy Center. IPAC is part of Caltech, and in particular I work for the Spitzer Science Center. So Spitzer is it's an infrared satellite. It's one of the three big satellites launched by NASA. The other two are Hubble and GLAST.
Mm-hmm. You specifically work in infrared observations.
Yeah, I work within Spitzer. I work for MIPS, the MIPS instrument team. MIPS is one of the three instruments on board Spitzer. Mm-hmm. The other two are IRAC and IRS. MIPS covers the wavelengths between 24, 70, 160 micron.
Okay.
And in particular, within the team, I work for the 70 micron and the characterization of the array at 70 micron.
It's fun to think that these telescopes have got separate teams working on separate parts of the wavelength spectrum.
Yeah.
Why is that? It's just a different number, isn't it? Surely, why do you have to have a whole separate team working on a different wavelength band?
Well, we have different teams because, first of all, the different wavelengths are covered by, so the three instruments are very different from the technological point of view. So you really need a different expertise. So this is why we have different teams, because one person can be specialized in germanium, like I am, and somebody else can be specialized in a silicon array.
And this is what the CCD cameras are made of.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So it's down to the instrumentation and the material science, basically, that you're expert in.
You basically need a little bit of background in this respect. Mm. And so what we do within the team is really the we try to, let's say, study all the properties of the array. Now that Spitzer has been in flight for 5 years, so we have lots of data that we can use for characterizing the behavior. We can also use all the data which were taken in the lab before the launch. So we, of course, also use those data. But in flight, so in space, things usually are different than in the lab. And so this is why we need to do this work of characterization.
How close can you get to in situ experiments in the lab? How close can you get to the telescope being in space, working in the lab?
Well, you get, in a way, quite close to the behavior. But then there are always surprises. So in a way, you roughly know before the launch, for example, how the sensitivity is going to be of the array, how the angular resolution is going to be. But then, for example, again, for the MIPS array, once the satellite was launched, it was found out that half of the array was dead.
Half the array was dead?
Half of it is dead, and it's permanently dead. And, of course, it couldn't be repaired because it was already space. Mm. So you had to live with it, and the data actually of the other half of the array are very good. But that means basically you have to characterize something that is completely unexpected. So you have to try to understand, for example, what the impact of the dead part on the part which is actually working is. That's one of the problems. Mm. And also in terms of coverage, that means a very big problem because you expect you to cover the sky with a full array and you end up having a half on the array. So there are lots of problems like this on along the way.
How can half a dead CCD array affect the good half, the living half?
Well, one of the problems, that was basically at the very beginning, in 2003 when Spitzer was launched, and basically after a few months, even before that, the engineers realized that basically half of it was dead. And the problem was an electronic connection, basically, of that part of the array with the rest of the spacecraft. So at the beginning, since it was not clear exactly which cables were involved in this process, we really needed to know, well, exactly what part of the array was bad and what part was working. Then once we realized that it was just a cable, and I say just, because fortunately that means the other part of the array is fine. Mm. But basically at that stage it was clear that the part which is alive, let's say, is not affected really by the other part. but at the beginning it was not clear if it was something more severe, so you can have some problems of like crosstalks, let's say, right, things like that.
Why could you not send astronauts to Spitzer to fix Spitzer in the same way that we could fix Hubble?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that, well, that's very expensive. That's basically probably the answer. And NASA, especially these days, is very careful about expenses. So whenever you can avoid doing something like that, you avoid doing it. And since, for example, it was clear that we could live without the array, so that the mission is not lost, also because we have other two instruments, IRAC and IRS. So it was basically clear since the beginning that the problem could be solved from the ground, just basically characterizing the array, and so that avoids sending basically a space shuttle in space with astronauts, with all the costs related to the
space. Are you shuttle. Mainly an instrument scientist?
No.
What else
no,
do you do?
Actually, my background is completely different. So before I arrived in Spitzer, I was working for Planck. So I'm a Planck scientist. I'm still involved with Planck. And I was basically my work within Planck has always been the characterization of the foregrounds.
Remind us a little bit about Planck first before you go on.
Okay, so Planck is mainly ESA, so the European Space Agency project, but has also a very big involvement from NASA. It's a satellite which is going to be launched next year from the French Guiana, from Kiruna. It's going to be launched by Ariane.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of this satellite is to study the cosmic microwave background, which is the relic of the Big Bang, let's say, and in particular the temperature and polarization and isotropies of the CMB. So that's the main goal of Planck.
It's essentially the successor to WMAP.
Yes.
And WMAP was a successor to COBE, so
exactly.
it's the next in a line of satellites studying
yes.
The cosmic microwave
Absolutely.
Background.
Absolutely.
How much better is Planck going to be over WMAP?
So the jump is going to be very big with Planck, because we are going to have, for example, a frequency coverage much bigger. So WMAP was covering just the relatively low radio frequencies, so from 20 to 90 gigahertz. While with Planck, we are going to go all the way to 857 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. So it's a very big jump in frequency coverage. And having lots of frequency channels means that also you can keep track of the foregrounds much better, which means basically that you can remove all the contaminants with respect to the CMB much better than what WMAP did.
This is a big problem, isn't it? Because you mentioned before about your work in that Spitzer, understanding the systematics of the instrumentation, working out exactly how it's performing in these in the telescope in orbit. You have to make sure that what you're measuring when the numbers come off the telescope, your images, you're actually measuring something real rather than just an instrument behaving slightly oddly. In this case, it's a little bit different. When you talk about foregrounds, you're talking about some real physical phenomenon.
Hmm.
In between us and the cosmic microwave background, which is this, they call it the surface of last scattering,
right,
back after the Big Bang. You're talking about something real out there, something which is causing a foreground signal. Mm. Explain a little bit of what you mean by a foreground signal.
So a foreground signal is a signal which is emitted, as you were saying, from a real physical emitter, in this case, which can be our galaxy or external galaxies. And this emission is overlapped to the emission that we want to study. So it's, for the cosmology, foregrounds are something like, an emission that they want to get rid of. So they want to remove this emission, which is, again, overlapped on a signal, which is a very tiny little signal, which is the emission produced by the cosmic microwave background, which is at the level of the noise, actually, of the instrument. So basically we need to dig into the data to find the kind of holy grail of cosmology, which is CMB, the temperature and isotropies, and even more polarization, which is an even smaller signal. And to do that, we need to remove all this emission, which is produced by our galaxy and by external galaxies. And in order to do that, we need a lot of modeling, which is the preparatory work that we do before a mission like Planck. A mission like Planck has been optimized in order to have all these big frequency coverages for coverage, again, to remove this emission as much as we can.
So you start off with a model of our galaxy in this case. What are you modeling? Are you modeling the gas, the stars, the dark matter? What exactly are you putting into your galactic model?
Basically, we try to model everything at the same time, and that's the tough goal. Because our knowledge, and that in a way this is very surprising, that our knowledge of our galaxy in this frequency range is still quite poor. And that's the surprise, in a way, because we, as cosmologists, we can predict the emission from the CMB with very big accuracy, but at the same time, we cannot predict with the same accuracy the emission from our own galaxy. So that's the tough challenge, in a way, because of this emission from 23 gigahertz all the way to 857 gigahertz, which is the emission covered by the bands of Planck, is a mixture of many different physical mechanisms. So we have a synchrotron radiation, which is produced, for example, by the cosmic rays accelerated by the magnetic field of our galaxy. We have the free emission, which is produced by the ionized gas of our galaxy. And then we have dust emission, which is produced by the dust in our galaxy. And then we have this called anomalous emission. And we call it anomalous because we don't even know what it is.
Oh, very good.
So it's also called the X emission. And nowadays we know for sure that we have a fourth component, but we don't know what is responsible basically for this emission. We think it is like grains of dust, very small grains of dust, but we are not sure.
Is it important to know what it is, I mean, this anomalous emission, or can you just say it's there and we can subtract it? Is that enough?
Yes and no. Because yes and no. Because in a way, for example, in an experiment like Planck, we have set up a group of people, which is very big. And these people apply what are called component separation methods. So they take the data produced by a mission like Planck, and they apply these methods, which are supposed to be blind, so they don't make assumptions on the components of emissions, for example, the foregrounds and the CMB, and they just try to disentangle the components which are in the data. So they basically say, okay, I have a map A, and I know that this map A is made of a component B, C, D, and E. I don't know what these components are, and I just try to separate them out. Or there are component separation methods which make some little assumptions, because we know that to avoid making assumptions and to work in a completely blind way for these methods is very complicated. So this is a way to go. The problem is that when you end up with these maps and you don't know what the physical mechanisms are, you don't know if what you have subtracted, let's say what you have separated out and distinguished from the CMB, is really physical or not. Mm. It could be something spurious, and if you don't know, if you don't have any physical ground, you can really end up with something totally fake. Or it could be noise, and you basically have no idea. So this is why you really need some knowledge, and this is what we are doing a little bit at the moment.
One question which might be a bit naive, although we are, the Sun is going around the center of the galaxy, in the plane of the galaxy, in the disk of the galaxy, so we are part of the galactic disk. Are there directions which we can point Planck? which are going to be less affected by the galaxy than others?
So that's a very good question. So with Planck, like WMAP or COBE, these are full sky experiments. So they cover the entire sky, including the galaxy. After acquiring the data, what we are going to do to really study the CMB, so the cosmic microwave background, is in general, we mask the galaxy. That's the first thing we do.
Just blank it out.
Yeah. Because at the end, recovering the CMB is a statistical, statistical signal. So you just want to make sure that you don't mask a too big region in the sky. Otherwise, you end up with too little statistics, and that's a problem for what we call map-making methods. And map-making are these methods which recover a map of the CMB, and also after that to recover the cosmological parameters. That is what we want. So we need to make sure that we don't mask too much. But that's usually the first approach. You don't look for the CMB in the plane of the galaxy, because that would be a lost battle, basically, because the foregrounds are going to win. We don't know the foregrounds, the level of subtracting them out so well that we manage to recover the CMB in the galaxy. So we are obliged to do this. So once again, unfortunately, we do need to know some of the physics of these foregrounds. And we are not at the stage yet. We are not good enough to do that. So that's one step, blanking the galaxy. But at the same time, these experiments have as a goal also to recover maps of the foregrounds. Because in fact, at the same time, we also want to improve our knowledge of these foregrounds for the future experiments.
You just don't want to say, oh, it's just an annoying signal, let's get rid of it and get to the good bit,
exactly,
which is the CMB.
Exactly.
It's interesting in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, because cosmologists, in these big experiments, there are cosmologists and people who are interested, actually, in these emissions, like myself. I belong to the second category. So it's a complex game in which some people see these emissions like trash, in a way. Mm-hmm. They want to get rid of it. But the other people, they say, no, this is important. And again, it is important also for cosmology, because the better we know these foregrounds, the better we will be able to recover the CMB in the future.
Mm.
Polarization.
Now, Planck isn't flying at the moment, so you're obviously not getting the data from Planck to model the foregrounds. Where are you getting the information from to model the foreground signal?
So we basically get the information from all the previous experiments, including WMAP. And COBE, but WMAP in this respect is basically the best source of information, but also from lots of other ancillary data. So, for example, for the synchrotron M33, there are experiments, observations, which are done specifically aiming at the observation of the synchrotron and the 33. So, for example, for synchrotron, we go to very low frequencies, like Haslam. The Haslam map, which is, was done by the Jodrell Bank Observatory, actually. And Haslam is a map of 408 megahertz. And the idea is really to look in the frequency range in which you know that a specific emission from the galaxy is going to dominate. So you don't have to worry about the other components. You can look at one specific component, but you have to go to a very specific frequency, in this case 408.
What's special about 408 megahertz?
408 megahertz is, let's say, is low enough that, again, 33 doesn't really kick in, let's say. So the synchrotron is very high because in this case there's a power law. And so at 408 megahertz, it really dominates. And then also in terms of technology, it is, let's say, a relatively easy frequency to observe, because then we have also to come to terms with technology. We can observe at any given frequency, because like filters are optimized in specific ranges. So that's the other part of the problem. So on one side, there's theoreticians we would like to observe at some given frequencies, but on the other side, we have to compromise with what the technology can offer.
When will you be satisfied that you have modeled the foregrounds accurately enough that you can say to the people who are interested in the cosmic microwave background, here you go, this is the signal that we expect to be due to these foreground physical processes. The rest is the CMB. At what point do you say, we've done it, we've modeled it correctly?
This is a very big question, because I think there is such a long way to go with the foregrounds. The problem of the foregrounds is that nowadays, an experiment like Planck, for example, is capable of observing the CMB at a resolution of 5 arc minutes. We don't have templates, so models of the foregrounds at 5 arc minute resolution. So, for example, for the synchrotron that I was mentioning before, our best template, the Haslam template, is almost at 1 degree. So we can see the gap between 1 degree and 5 arc minutes. And in between, we don't know, we have basically to scale down with models because we don't have the data. So that's one of the problems. The other problem I was mentioning is the anomalous emission. We don't know even what it is. It was found, it was discovered a bit more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But then it took almost 10 years to convince people that it was really there, because people didn't believe it. So for anomalous emission, still we need to do everything. The other problem is the polarization, because all these experiments, all the future experiments of CMB, not only want to look at the temperature anisotropies, but they want to look at polarization of the CMB. That's really the holy grail of cosmology. Because looking at polarization, we can even more break the degeneracy between all the cosmological models. And that's the only way we can really do it. The problem is that we basically need the information in polarization for all the foregrounds. And at the moment, we basically don't have any kind of information. So we know that synchrotron is polarized, we know that refit is basically not polarized, we know that dust is polarized, but we basically don't know how, we don't have maps. And so it's going to take a very long time, I think, because before we will manage to fill up all these gaps.
So you mentioned that in order to discriminate between competing cosmological models for the observed temperature anisotropies in the CMB, we now look toward the polarization. The polarization itself, is just simply the angle of polarization looking in different directions in the sky?
Yes. Yeah. The concept that for CMB is basically exactly what applies to any other light, the series of visible light. So we basically think that there was an imprint in the photons of CMB at the surface of last scattering. So they basically got polarized on the surface. And this polarization keeps the track of basically of this surface of last scattering. So it can really tell us, for example, if we know that there is a signal which is due to gravitational waves. So, and this signal can be basically seen in polarization. And that's the way basically we can say, okay, we see a polarized signal in the CMB. So we know that there are basically perturbations in the primordial universe which are due to gravitational waves. And that's basically the only way to see it. Otherwise, we have no way to directly see it. The only way is through polarization of the CMB. And this is why polarization is going to open up a complete new perspective on the CMB and on the primordial universe itself.
It's remarkable to think that we've gone from just looking at the CMB, and in the first observations it looked completely flat. It looked just like a black body, and there was none of these little wiggles anywhere. In whatever direction you looked at, it looked completely flat, just like a black body. And then when COBE flew and they did their analysis and they could discover these little temperature fluctuations of, what's the order of the temperature fluctuations?
Temperature minus 5.
Tiny fluctuations.
Yes.
And how much harder is it to detect the polarization signal than the temperature signal now?
Yeah. So polarization is the real challenge, because nowadays basically all the experiments for detecting temperature anisotropies, all the experiments are basically in quite a good shape. polarization is a very different business in a way, because polarization is 10%, represents 10% of the fluctuations in temperature. So if we have a signal of 10 to the minus 5 Kelvin, in polarization it's going to be 10 to the minus 6. So it's going to be a very tiny little signal. And the problem is really the 4 grams. I go back to the 4 grams because for polarization, since we are basically so ignorant in the way the 4 grams are polarized, the challenge is really to distinguish a signal that is so tiny from something that is so dominant and so unknown. So are we going to be able to do this? That's a big challenge. In a way, nobody knows. We think we can, because again, an experiment as Planck has been designed to have a sufficient frequency coverage to disentangle all these components, even if we don't really know how they behave. But we can basically exploit all the knowledge we have in terms of frequency dependencies of the foregrounds and anyway all the physics that we know that these foregrounds follow to make this separation. But I think just the Planck data will answer this question, and so hopefully we will manage to detect the polarization.
Will Planck be the first instrument to measure the CMB polarization?
On a full sky level, yes, definitely. The WMAP did produce polarized maps. But again, the problem was that WMAP was not sufficiently, first of all, was less sensitive than Planck. So when an instrument is less sensitive, it means the noise dominates over a signal which is so tiny, like, for example, the polarization that you want to measure. So Planck is much more sensitive, so it should go down to a level of, let's say, of signal to noise, which WMAP couldn't achieve. That was one thing. Other experiments have observed the CMB. CBI is one of these experiments, which is the cosmic background imager in Caltech, actually. There are other experiments like DAISY. It's an interferometer at the South Pole. Now there is a balloon which is going to be launched the next year, which is called Polar Bear. So there are lots of experiments. The problem of all these experiments is usually that, again, they don't have a full sky coverage, so statistically they have a much less amount of data to study. The other problem is they don't reach, again, the frequency coverage of Planck. That's always a big problem when you want to disentangle the foreground. So, again, I don't want to advertise here Planck, but Planck is going to be basically the first experiment which may really give not a definite answer, of course, but at least a robust detection.
So the data from these other experiments you mentioned are not sufficient to help you out with the problem of this anomalous signal, anomalous polarization signal, so you can't even get a handle on where to start with the models to see whether any of them agree with the current data. So you're really hoping that the data that come from Planck will be in themselves enough to give you the CMB and also this anomalous signal, or the foregrounds anyway.
Yes, well, in fact, because we have two problems. One is the polarization of the CMB that I mentioned, and the other one is the anomalous emission for the foreground. And in a way, Planck could be the experiment answering these two questions, because on one side, it will be the first experiment to produce a full sky map of the anomalous emission, which is the emission of the galaxy. It's one of the components of the galactic emission. And on the other side, it could be the first experiment giving a detection of the polarization on a full sky, and probably detected in the cleanest way so far. So could answer both these questions, which would be good.
Very exciting. We're looking forward to hearing the results.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time. And thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.